You're listening to St. PDEX Season 2. Today's episode is brought to you by CapEx Advisory Group. When organizations undertake large capital or real estate projects, they turn to CapEx for additional resources and expertise. To learn what an owner's rep can do for you, visit CapEx's website at ceag2.com. That's C-E-A-G, the number 2.com. And by the Open Partnership Education Network, located at the University of South Florida in St. Petersburg. The world is open for citizens, businesses, groups, for all of us to become a smarter, better connected city by learning together. To find out more about Open, including upcoming great Aresti speakers, please visit learnopen.org. Now enjoy the conversation. Joining me on SPX is author Gilbert King. Welcome, sir.
Great to be here, Joe.
So you've got three books out. You have The Execution of Willie Francis, Devil in the Grove, which won you a small award.
Yeah, a little one.
And your newest one, Beneath the Ruthless Sun.
Right.
All three of those are around a central theme. And I'd like to know what took you down that road.
Well, you know, they basically all start with crime stories. I've always been interested in crime stories, always been reading them. And it feels like my whole life leading up to this moment has been like reading crime stories and like, what can I do? And ultimately, I studied writing and I started investigating the first one, which was The Execution of Willie Francis. And just to give you a little background about it, and you can tell why I would be interested in it, it was a story of a 16-year-old African-American in Louisiana back in the 1940s. Mm-hmm. And back then, they had a traveling electric chair. So what they would do is they'd put it in the back of a truck, take it out of Angola, which was the big prison, and then ride around with it and execute people in various parishes, and then bring it back to the main prison. That was the way they did it back then. And in this particular case, a Cajun town in St. Martinville, Louisiana, there were some political problems happening with the warden. And so instead of sending out the usual execution team, they sent out a prisoner and a guard and said, go ahead, take care of this execution. Taught them how to work the electric chair real quick. But these guys were like drinking the whole night before, drinking into the morning, and they didn't hook the chair up properly. So when Willie Francis's time came to sit in the chair and he got the electricity, it was a lot, but not enough to kill him. And so he survived his own execution. And they didn't quite know what to do. You know, the governor was like, well, fix the chair and put him back in. And one of the lawyers said, I think there might be a problem with like, you know, cruel and unusual punishment or double jeopardy. And so they decided to just throw him in a cell and wait. And it went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. So it's still a case that is looked at today for cruel and unusual punishment. Mm-hmm. And so when I heard that story, I was like, what? I never heard of this before. Like someone survived their own execution. So I started looking into the case and I found out when I went down there that it wasn't quite what the official version was. There was another side to the story about the crime and the murder that he was accused of. And so that just really all started it for me. It was just a matter of like just getting into this crime story, but in the same time, learning about civil rights, the law, American history, and all those things are just really interesting to me.
So when you have that experience of wanting to dig into that, how much of it is solving the puzzle and how much of it is the justice element of it?
I think it comes together, but it starts as like, I feel like I'm a detective in history and I'm going back and looking at this and I'm trying to track down witnesses. I'm trying to just see if there's anything I can find that maybe has never been written before or is not the real version. And in this particular case, I figured out early on some old timers were there, people in their 80s. Mm-hmm. And they were the ones that were telling me, no, that's the official version of that, but we know what the real story is. And they went on to say that this kid was framed and it was just a conspiracy. And so pretty much that's what the entire book is about. But it's ultimately about the justice system, but it all really starts with a crime story, something to keep people really interested, like what happened here? And then by the end, you say, that's not really fair. That's not the American justice system I'm aware of.
You know, usually when you think of injustice, there's sort of an anger or rage attached to it, right? And you can expel some of that by putting your work out and getting the word out there. But ultimately, a lot of the dark side players in these books that you've written never came to justice. McCall being the big one, you know, died pretty much having gotten away with it all.
Yeah.
And so, you know, A, the fact that you're seeing how systemic this problem is, and B, that even when you reveal it, it can go on for 28 years or however long he was there and then on to the end of his life.
Right.
So, you know, how has that sort of evolved in you as you've gone and experienced this for so long and seen these injustices happen so deeply?
That's a really great question, because that is a common theme that you find when you write these kind of nonfiction stories. They don't always have the kind of endings you expect. If you, you know, read fiction or you watch Hollywood movies, you sort of want the comeuppance. You don't want the bad guy to just keep getting away with it. The sad part about American history and a lot of these justice stories that I find that myself writing, they don't have those kind of happy endings. That justice is there, but maybe in a very like slow way, it plays out over time. So it's important for me to like latch on to somebody like Thurgood Marshall, when maybe he's losing the case, but he's setting precedent and he's changing hearts and minds along the way. And so maybe there are changes to the justice system, which is exactly what happened with Thurgood Marshall. He didn't win every case, but he got the Supreme Court to see them and hear them, and that led to the changes later on. Mabel Norris Reese was a reporter who worked in both of those stories in Lake County. And, you know, again, it took years. She doesn't really have any victories. And ultimately, when it comes, it feels kind of hollow because, you know, someone spent 14 years in the worst mental hospital of all time. And, you know, basically, wasn't like they were, justice was, this man still served 14 years.
And you're referring to your latest book when you
right.
talk about
this. Right. This is in Beneath the Ruthless Sun. Jesse Daniels is a teenage, mentally disabled kid. Is framed for a crime that he didn't commit. And it takes 14 years for it to unwind. So he basically loses his early life to this horrible prison. So those are the kind of outcomes you have. But my ultimate aim is to have people sort of follow and identify the protagonists like Thurgood Marshall and Mabel Norris Reese and see what they were up against and what they were fighting for at a time when like they were the least popular people in these areas.
And they become aspirationals. And ideally, that drives other people to see some of that opportunity to do this or those things in their own lives.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I've talked to people who said, you know, I went to law school because I read your book in high school, and that's just what I wanted to do with my life. And I'm hearing now the same thing from people who want to be journalists. They want to, you know, either report on the criminal justice system or be like a muckraker and just investigate business. And I think they're just inspired by these stories because these people literally put their lives on the line. It wasn't like today where you have journalists who are like the enemy of the people. But, you know, in America, we still, there's not really a lot of violence associated with that. Well, it's kind of getting there with these, you know, rallies that you see where, you know, people are turning against journalists. But back in the day, they were actually trying to kill them and kill people like Thurgood Marshall and Mabel Norris Reese. So they were risking their lives for these stories.
So once you're in this loop, once you dig in to see these things that have happened, you have an outlet for being part of the solution. You get stories of having inspired people. I mean, can you write a book that doesn't have that gravitas going forward, or are you pretty much stuck for the rest of your life because of that?
You know, it's funny, but like, I think when I first started, I didn't know what books I was going to be writing. And if I really got addicted to this. I feel like there's so many of these kind of stories out there that are untold, that are kind of lost to history. And I'm 57 years old. These books take me a little more than 5 years, every book. So I'm trying to weigh, like, how many more do I have in me? And what do I really want to do with my life? You know, I could write, I guess, probably find more commercial topics that would be bigger sellers. But I'm just really, at this point in my life, I'm really not interested. I like these kind of lost crime stories that tell a bigger story about what America is really like.
Right. I'm assuming, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that when you share your stories with people, even though you're sharing them as a journalist, because there are really so, it's such a pervasive problem, but it's also tough to define. And do you get a lot of people looking to you as to be a thought leader in how to handle racial injustice and looking for solutions?
You know, I probably do. And it's a difficult role to sort of get used to. I'm trying to like rely on people that I consider my idols or mentors, people like Bryan Stevenson of the Equal Justice Initiative, and seeing how they conduct themselves and what they really believe is important to do. And one of the things that these leaders talk about is truth and reconciliation, similar to what happened in South Africa after apartheid. They had a government, you know, commission that basically gave immunity to people and said, we know that the system of apartheid led to some really horrible things. We don't want these stories to be called fake news or to be, you know, believed by a certain population to be untrue or conspiracy. So basically they offered immunity to people who would testify to all the things that they'd done and just get these stories out there and get to the truth so that it could never be questioned. And, you know, here in the United States, we've never had that kind of truth and reconciliation. So it's really fallen on the laps of writers and lawyers to sort of explore these stories. And so I think that's really what the thing that I try to think most about is before you can get to reconciliation, you have to get to truth. And I think there's a value in digging out these stories. And, you know, hopefully people will notice and say that we can't tolerate. We don't want that in our country.
In the United States, what have you seen as some of the most effective and natural evolution propellants, we'll call it, for reducing racism over the years.
Yeah, I don't know if this is just self-serving, but I do believe that storytelling plays a really important part in that. And, you know, if you look, let's just take, for instance, Ava DuVernay has a new documentary, or it's a new dramatic series out on HBO, I believe, or Netflix, I can't remember now, and it was about the Central Park Five. And now Ken Burns and his daughter did a documentary about that maybe 10 years ago, and it was a brilliant documentary. It really exposed the whole truth behind it. Mm-hmm. But it shows you the difference between that 10 years when Ken Burns did that film and now when Ava DuVernay did it. This was a dramatization of that story. And yet the repercussions, you saw Linda Fairstein, who is the prosecutor of the Central Park Five. She was forced out of all these boards. Her publisher abandoned her and basically said that, you know, no more books with our company. Right. And so accountability came many, many years later, but it was because of the strength of storytelling. And I think social media played a huge part of that too.
Yeah, and that's something I've always had not as clear of a lens into is, you know, I think we've gotten so good at storytelling and the media has become so effective, and even the psychology of storytelling. There's just so many great films and documentary style films and series and books, and they're great at arousing, you know, the emotion. And then I always wonder, there's a huge cliff for activating any kind of fix to that. But you're telling me that, and we'd mentioned earlier, the aspirational characters that people could mold themselves after, B, accountability. What are some of the other things you would like to see more on the solutions front to sort of continue to be the next part of the story that you start with revealing the problem?
Yeah, I think like the next phase for me would be some kind of government accountability and sort of taking these stories and saying, oh, we recognize that people are outraged by what we're seeing. How are we going to correct that? One of the examples I would use is Devil in the Grove. So that book came out in 2012. But slowly it began to gain some momentum. And then people in the legislature started reading it as a book club thing. And a couple of the Democrats said, we need to do something about this. Let's sponsor a claims bill and just correct the situation. We'll do apologies and pardons. And all of a sudden you saw on the other side of the aisle, a Republican book club started reading it too. And they had a competition to see who could get more co-sponsors for this claims bill. And the next thing you know, it's on the floor of the legislature and they're voting on it and apologizing to the families of the Groveland boys. And just in January, Governor Ron DeSantis and the Clemency Board officially pardoned the Groveland boys. It was like his second day in office. I don't really know if that would have been possible if this book had not been published, because really it wasn't being talked about at all.
Right.
And so, you know, people have told me that, but, you know, it still took years and it took a lot of grassroots efforts, petitions and powerful people in Florida saying, we want to get behind that. But, you know, ultimately, I think it was a really great moment in Florida government. They looked at it and said, well, it's true. This is in the past, and an apology is not going to bring anybody back to life or get anybody out of prison. But, you know, we are also responsibility for the credibility of the criminal justice system. And if we don't acknowledge we got it wrong here, that has repercussions in the present and the future. And I think they got that part of it right.
And the thing that jumped out there is, I think the victim showed up at the courthouse and basically lobbied against that happening, which, you know, you wonder if she even really remembers. Or which sort of leads to my next question is, how much of history can you actually trust? You know, you grow up reading the one history book that everybody in public school got, and then all of a sudden you realize that, man, that was just somebody sitting in a room.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and that's an interesting point, because I was at that hearing, and I think the Groveland families would call her the alleged victim.
Alleged victim, yeah.
But it was a very powerful moment, because I tried to interview her about 10 years ago, and she didn't want to talk to me at all. In fact, she hadn't talked to anybody in about 70 years since the case ended back in 1951. And she hadn't spoken to anybody. And I tried to get her to talk, and she basically said, let sleeping dogs lie. She didn't want to revisit it. But, you know, 70 years later, she came into the hearing room this past January, and she basically stuck to the same story, and she was against the pardons. But, you know, so much time had passed, and the entire investigation that I put in the book, all this evidence that was never really available to the defense at the time, you know, I was able to really demonstrate that there was manufactured evidence, there was perjury, prosecutorial misconduct. It wasn't so much about a he said, she said thing. It was what happened to the Groveland boys in their trial. And that was an abomination of justice. That was the reason for the pardons and ultimately the exonerations.
And it actually introduces a whole nother layer of injustice, because you have in government records, in FBI, in a box, you know, in an FBI building, clear proof that this was a bad situation and it was wrong, and it just sat there until you did your Freedom of Information request.
Yeah, and I think that was the most disturbing part of it, when I saw that, you know, I like to talk about Sheriff Willis McCall and, you know, what a dangerous, evil, violent sheriff that he was in Lake County. But, you know, this never would have been possible unless every layer of Florida government had Willis McCall's back. So, and you saw that with the judge in the trial, the prosecutor, the governor was terrified of him too, because he had bad information about the governor, about bribes and kickbacks and all that. And even the U.S. attorney in Tampa, he was a white supremacist himself. And so there was no interest in protecting the civil rights of every member of American citizenry. So that was, I think, the most disturbing. All this evidence that was there, and it was never seen by anyone, the defense or anyone, was just thrown away in this box and sealed for 70 years. So it's just kind of disturbing to see that.
I don't know if there's really a way to answer this, but one other interesting thing I thought about was the transformation of Mabel Norris Reese, right? So she was really towing the line in McCall's fiefdom, right? And then she had this transformation, and ultimately, you know, she's revealed as a good person. And so to me, it's interesting in how it parallels America, and that these people are not bad people, but they are racist. And so what were sort of takeaways from that personal transformation in her that you could sort of expound out to society in the U.S.?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really important point. And what happened was she moved down from Ohio, and she was basically writing the sheriff's version of everything that happened in the criminal justice system. And she kind of had her blinders on. And I find it hard to imagine how that was possible, because she was a very bright woman. Mm-hmm. But she was reporting on the case, and she really was taking the prosecution side of it continually. And I think it was once Sheriff Willis McCall had shot the two Groveland boys on the side of the road, like on the evening of their retrial. She saw that as a clear execution attempt. And that's when she changed. And her whole arc changes at that point. She's determined to go after Willis McCall and write about, you know, the justice system without compromising herself anymore. And I think part of it was that she got called out by the U.S. Supreme Court in Justice Jackson's opinion, basically pointed to the media bias in Lake County. That was her. Mm-hmm. Her version of events was sort of tainting the jury pool and really tainting justice. And so, like, when Justice Jackson wrote his opinion, he said, this case presents one of the best examples of one of the worst menaces to American justice. And he wasn't just talking about the sheriff. He was talking about the way the case was covered, the way it was trumpeted in the media. And so I think Mabel really is a great example of that. And for the rest of her life in Lake County, which is another 10 years, she was constantly writing about McCall and, you know, the things that she faced her. You know, she had a cross burned in her front lawn that nearly, you know, caught her house on fire. Her dog was poisoned. Someone threw a strychnine poisoned steak over the fence. Her house was bombed. Her office was vandalized and destroyed. Ultimately, this I found really remarkable. Some white supremacists in the area opened up a rival newspaper, and Willis McCall went around and just said to all her advertisers, don't advertise with that Mount Dora topic anymore if you know what's good for you. And that was enough back then, because Willis McCall was, you know, his threats were taken seriously.
And that actually, the juxtaposition of all of those facets of how hard it is to unconcrete that foundation. And when people, I say that, that's the weird position you end up being in, is probably one of the leading experts just because of your, you know, being in it, on having any semblance of an idea of how to combat it, right? Because it's just, it's so multifaceted.
It really is. And, you know, I think Mabel was on to something. She recognized the importance, but, you know, she was putting her livelihood on the line, and also the economic security of her newspaper. I mean, they destroyed her newspaper. She had to leave town, leave the county. And so she faced, you know, a tremendous amount of difficulty. It wasn't easy. You know, all of that reporting on Willis McCall, I mean, Willis McCall had friends, and things were happening to people who stood up to Willis McCall. She liked to say that, you know, her greatest insurance policy was that if anything happened to her, everyone would know it was Willis McCall. I don't know why she felt safe about that, because he didn't care. He'd been investigated 49 times for civil rights violations, and he beat every single one of them. So, you know, he was protected in the state of Florida.
If you look at the, you know, the whole landscape, and I know Florida is not south of the South, as they say, but
right,
if you were to sort of map the landscape of, we'll just call it east of the Mississippi, how many McCalls were there, do you think, at that time? I mean, how many didn't have a Gilbert King to ruin their day?
Yeah, you know, I think that's a great question. The reason why sometimes people ask me, you know, what was it about Willis McCall? There were other sheriffs quite like that. I don't think there was any sheriff as violent that I've come across at all. But there were other sheriffs in that vein. But Willis McCall liked to call attention to himself. And so he would be out there in the press speaking a lot, basically challenging the government to come after him, saying, I have nothing to hide. He would say things like, you can stick a knife in my back and I'm like a gator. He could just pull it right out, you know, that kind of stuff. And it was kind of true. I mean, he had beaten every single investigation. I think he was unique, but not completely unique.
Right.
I don't think there was anyone as violent as him. But because he called so much attention to himself and all these investigations happened because of him, they were all sealed. So nobody really ever saw them. There were no consequences. So when I go through these, you know, file of Freedom of Information Act requests, and I go through it, I find people in his, you know, sheriff's department who are informants for the FBI. And they're telling about things he did,
right,
and things they witnessed, showing the FBI photographs of killings. And so it's a pretty detailed file that he's left behind in his wake. I don't think he expected anyone to ever see these, but, you know, they're there. And I've done two books about Lake County, so I've gone through everything. And, you know, he was much worse than I even thought when I was doing the first. In fact, I thought maybe I would make him a minor character in the second book because I really didn't want to revisit his life again. And then I just saw all the things he was doing. You would have thought that after all that attention, after shooting the two Groveland boys, mm-hmm, going on the front page of, you know, all these newspapers across the country, that he might have been chastened a little bit and maybe just been a little more careful. But he actually went the other way. He was more emboldened and he got more violent after that.
Again, we have to subtract it because I don't want to make this a judgment thing, subtract out the evil piece of it. But more, if we look at him as McCall the politician, you know, should we say that he has a parallel style to any other politicians today?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you say that because at the time I was writing Beneath a Ruthless Sun, it was the election of 2016. And so you were inundated with election news and Trump was in the news every single day.
Yeah.
And, you know, it recalled to me like the times where he would just say enemy of the people, fake news, and just gaslighting the press and just trying to make them appear to his base as just totally unreliable, printing lies. And that's exactly what Willis McCall was doing with Mabel. He would call her Red Mabel, accuse her of being a communist.
So actually put the nickname at the beginning of the other name, which again is a pretty massive parallel, right?
Yeah, he's just doing the nicknames thing.
Yeah, yeah.
I would say that Willis McCall, believe it or not, was much more sophisticated.
Mm-hmm.
He had a real plan to survive. I think Trump is kind of winging it and overwhelming people with his comments, but Willis McCall had a very specific goal and he would sort of, you know, play to the FBI's paranoia about the threat of communism.
Mm-hmm.
And he would just start labeling all his enemies communists. And it really did work.
Yeah.
It kept the FBI off his back. You know, Trump, he never accused him of murdering somebody, but, you know, he did famously say that, you know, I could stand on Fifth Avenue and shoot someone and not lose any of my support. And, you know, I think there's some truth to that. And it's definitely the case with Willis McCall. When he shot the Groveland boys, some reporters said, you know, what's this going to do to your political career now? This is a big story. You're responsible for these killings. You know, you got an election coming up. You think you'll win another term? And he said, I think I can win 7 more terms because of this. I mean, that's how bold he was, and he was not wrong.
So how do we deconstruct that? Why does that work?
Well, I think basically the main problem that you see, and you still see it today, and the sheriff is often the most powerful person in the county.
Mm-hmm.
So judges need the support of the sheriff in order to be elected. And because the sheriff is elected himself, he's answerable to the electorate. And at the time, in Lake County, the majority of the electorate supported that law and order, strong white supremacist in office. And that's what it was.
So he sort of hijacked the ideal and put that forth in a winning way and then slipped in all these other beliefs that he had.
I think hijacking the ideal is a great way to put it. That's exactly what he did. I mean, I think these sheriffs are usually put into place by the money,
mm-hmm,
the citrus barons in Willis McCall's case. And I remember working on this book thinking to myself, you know, this is pretty easy. Just follow the money. And that's where it's, you know, this is a formula that kind of works. Follow the money, that's where the power is, and that's where some of these decisions are going to originate. But what I came to find out that as powerful as the citrus barons were, you know, and when the Klan started burning down the black homes in Stuckey Still outside of Groveland, you saw the white citrus barons move in to help. They called in the National Guard, they sent trucks, they wanted all the workers moved to safety. And basically, it wasn't because they were racially enlightened, most of them. It was because they were protecting their business interests. You know, Florida had already seen Rosewood, Ocoee, and some of these mass exoduses. And when you have an exodus like that, it hurts your labor. So, you know, entire agricultural industries can be destroyed, mm-hmm, if there's an exodus of labor. And the people in Groveland were smart enough, they did not want that. So they end up protecting the African-American force. What happened as a result of that was the Klan, a large part of the electorate, threatened the rich business owners and citrus barons. Basically said, if you talk to the FBI, we burn down every business you own.
Mm.
And that was where the power was. It was the electorate. And Willis McCall knew that. And he kind of had to play both sides of the fence.
Interesting. And there's an equivalent to that today, which is reputation, right? Because we've seen people's political careers be taken up or down with the words and or slanders or endorsements or whatever. So that, you know, that leverage still exists for sure.
Absolutely. And it's interesting to see like people get emboldened when they don't lose any popularity and they just start saying these things and they realize their base loves that. And that's what happened with Willis McCall. They love to hear him talk tough and just sort of say, I'm a law and order sheriff. These are all code words for I'm going to keep the black man in his place. That was what he was running on. That's a lot of the way these sheriffs existed. I mean, I met with Stetson Kennedy once. I was talking to him while I was doing some research for Devil in the Grove. And, you know, he was a famous reporter who infiltrated the Ku Klux Klan. And he did a lot of writing about civil rights. And, you know, he said something I thought was really powerful and true. He said, you know, after the Civil War, the uniform of white supremacy was the white hood and robe. And as you moved along further away from Reconstruction into the 20th century, that the uniform changed and it became the uniform of law enforcement. That was the uniform that protected white supremacy in the South. And that's exactly what you see. You see less lynching, more death penalty. So if you do the kind of things that were going to get you lynched in the 1890s and early 1900s, as you move away to the 20s and 30s, it's no longer a lynching. It's more of a very fast, speedy trial where you're convicted and sent to the electric chair. And so that was really, you know, what the role of the sheriff's department was for the most part in the South.
Can you give your observations on then the our trajectory in general? So say we start in the 30s, 40s to, or just go back 100 years, to, you know, till now. Where do you think we've made the most progress and where do you think we're the slowest?
There's two parts to that question. I think one of the things is sometimes you look at the criminal justice system. I remember when Devil in the Grove came out, it came out like within a week or two of when Trayvon Martin was shot. And I remember going around doing talks and people saying, nothing has changed. Nothing has changed. It's the same as it's always been. And I remember thinking about that. And, you know, if you read Devil in the Grove, you see that the criminal justice system that existed in the 1940s in the South was horrible. I mean, it was just, it's unrecognizable. Because if you're used to watching television shows or reading, you know, novels, this doesn't look anything like what you're seeing in a courtroom. And so it's gotten so much better than that, thanks to people like Thurgood Marshall. Nowhere near perfect. You know, now we have a system of mass incarceration, which really didn't exist in the 30s and 40s. It's shifted. The problems have shifted. Segregation, that's not gone. It's just, it looks different. Now it's like an economic segregation. So we still have the problems, but it's important to recognize how much better things are, because when you go back and look at it, it's untenable. The second part of I think that answer is history tends to go in cycles. And I'll use this as an example, which I think illustrates it really well. And this came up while I was researching Beneath the Ruthless Sun. So that story takes place in the wake of Brown versus Board, 1954. You could argue that's the most important civil rights case of the 20th century. Thurgood Marshall actually argued it as the desegregation of the public schools. It was a 9-0 decision, very important towards civil rights. What happened in the wake of Brown versus Board was you saw the rebirth of the Ku Klux Klan. You saw the birth of these white citizen councils, like 300,000 members across 11 states. Mm-hmm. And these were like, Thurgood Marshall referred to them as the Uptown Klan. These were lawyers, doctors, politicians, all of them opposed to desegregation. And so the amount of racial terror that increased following Brown versus Board was really significant. Bombings across the South, resistance, threats constantly made to parents of school members or just board members. And so you have like this 2 steps forward with Brown, but then you'd have 1 big step backwards. But I remind people that the reaction to that racial terror that followed Brown was you move into the civil rights movement of the 1960s. Mm-hmm. And so that was another 2 steps forward. And I think that we have that in cycles that exist today. And for example, let's just use the example of the election of Barack Obama and the re-election. Forget what you think about him politically. That's not really part of the point. The point is that was one of the most significant things that the United States could have done was elected an African-American in a free election twice. And the reason you know that's significant is you have civil rights leaders who spent their life dedicated to the cause like John Lewis saying they never thought they'd see the day where the United States elected an African-American as president. So if they're surprised by it, and also very proud of it, there's no doubt that that was a significant moment in American history. I think there's also a step backwards, a reaction to that. I don't think Charlottesville would have happened in any other time unless there was a reaction to an African-American president and a correction? Was it too soon? This is what people sort of, you know, articulate when you talk about it was too soon. Country's not ready for an African-American. What does that even mean? Not ready. Like, how do you get ready for something like that? I never understood that sentence. But the reaction is not surprising given the cycles of history.
So to me, that is social evolution. And perhaps this was the big disconnect during the last election, is there's people who exist in a certain way who think we're perhaps a lot further along than we are. And then there's shocked and surprised when these things happen. And they were shocked, obviously, by the election of the current president. You know, is that the case where we sort of have two different currents running at two different speeds and they're just not really connecting with each other?
Yeah, I really think so. I mean, I think obviously a lot of things could have happened that would have made that not happen. Like, so let's just look at the Trump election. I mean, it was very close. I mean, he lost the popular vote by millions, but yet he won electorally. So it almost didn't happen.
Right.
And there was, you know, some last minute things that happened and, you know, James Comey and Russian involvement that could have made it different. But I think those currents always would have been running anyway. And I think the reason why is because we've never really addressed it as a nation. We've never had our moment where, like, you know, in Germany, you can't fly a Nazi flag out in Berlin or, you know, Hamburg, but you can fly a Confederate flag in the United States. And why is that? When you go to West Point, the U.S. Military Academy, you don't see Confederate flags. You don't see statues to Robert E. Lee. That doesn't exist. They're considered as traitors to the United States of America. And we don't display those flags or memorabilia or statues of Confederate heroes. But as a nation, we've never really addressed, you know, the origins of slavery and race in America. So I think these things are always these currents that you have running and certain events can tip them off. And, you know, I just think that this Truth and Reconciliation Commission that you saw following apartheid in Rwanda and South Africa, we've never had a government program like that to just sort of accept that this was wrong and maybe some form of reparations. You know, it doesn't have to be just cutting checks out to everybody, but there can be programs certainly maybe designed to make up for maybe the land that was stolen from Black farmers, those kind of things.
Sure.
And so, I mean, I think that the country just has a long way to go towards, you know, solving and addressing our past.
And so sort of stretching your experience out, you know, traditional discussion around race, and obviously because of the history you just mentioned with slavery, is the Black and white dynamic. But obviously, I think the stats are that whites will be in the minority in some number of years, 10 or 15 or 20 years. And so we have a large Latino community, and there's a lot of rhetoric around that right now. So how has that past racism transferred itself onto the relationships between whites and Latinos and Blacks and Latinos? How do you see that all mixing out?
I think there's like a lot better sociologists and people who have would probably be able to answer that question more effectively than I would. But I would just say, when I look at it, it seems to be like this sort of a last grasp of, you know, white supremacy or white dominance. And so obviously this nation is getting younger and this nation is getting more diverse and that's not going to stop. And so you do see these last minute or these last ditch efforts, I think, to protect the populace as we know it. We want to make America great again. Mm-hmm. Well, when was it great? I mean, I'm not saying that America was not a great country. It is a great country. But when was it at its greatest? If you ask that question, sometimes people don't really have an answer to it. Because a lot of times their answer is, oh, you mean back in Jim Crow days, back before the civil rights? Like, what was the time when America was great? And so try to define those things that you agree with about the greatness that you want to return to. I mean, I think make America great again when there wasn't mass shootings every day. Let's go back to those days. I mean, you could play that both ways.
Sure.
But I just think that the nation is changing. It's getting younger. I think changes come with young people. Even in the 40s, when I was doing a lot of research, I was amazed by what I was finding. There was one moment where the University of Texas Law School was trying to keep out African Americans. And Thurgood Marshall actually went down to Texas and argued this case. And what was really interesting and surprising and inspiring to me was that all of the white students at the University of Texas Law School decided that they were going to show up in that courtroom and sit with the African-American section. And they actually booed their dean, who was saying that whites needed to be kept separate and couldn't allow Blacks to come in. And they started booing their dean and they all came out and they joined the NAACP in protest. And it was at that moment that the chancellors and the school president couldn't hold off the momentum. And at that point, they had to integrate the school. And I just think that that change came about from young people. And you sort of, I think you see similar things like with gun violence and the Parkland movement. You're seeing young people really take the reins of this going into the 60s itself. A lot of older African Americans were helping with that, as well as Caucasians. But for the most part, it was a young person's movement. So I think that's just, you know, the way the world works. The younger people have more progressive ideas and they're more inclusive.
I'd like to spend at least a few minutes, just because I know some of our listeners will be interested in you as the writer, talking about the craft a little bit. You mentioned earlier 5 years to put a book out. What's that process like? Can you kind of walk through what that 5 years looks and feels like?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. I mean, and the funny thing is, if you're a nonfiction writer, nobody ever asks you process questions. Like, all my novelist friends get asked these kind of questions, like, what side of the paper do you write on? You know, like, they just care about me, the story that I'm writing about. So I actually like process questions. I would say if a book, I'll use it in general, because I've done three of them now like this, and they all took about a little more than 5 years. I write fairly fast. And so I write these stories in 1 year. The other four is all research. And I think that's one of the benefits and advantages I have to maybe someone who's a journalist who's working on a long form. They might only have a month to do a story, maybe a few months, luckily. But nowadays in newspapers, there's not a lot of newspapers that can invest in one journalist going out and working for a story for years. It's just not a model that works. So as an author, I'm sort of given a little bit of latitude. And I think that time and that patience really works well for me. So what I generally do is I move down to the places I'm covering and I stay for long amounts of time and I build up relationships. And, you know, sometimes it's not just one interview with somebody, it's like 20 interviews. And over time, memories begin to come back and I explore themes. And then I'm able to double check all their things that they're saying. And so I just have a longer deadline and I'm able to really just dive deeper and wait. You know, sometimes you file a Freedom of Information Act request, you might not get the files for 2.5, 3 years. And so you have to have that kind of deadline in order to be able to get those files, because everything has to be redacted. Most of the time has to be redacted and gone over so there's not personal details. And, you know, you go into a queue and it takes years to get to your stuff. And so I have to wait that out. But, you know, I really like that. I feel like in nonfiction, you can do a lot of world building. And so I like to learn everything I can about the citrus industry. Mm-hmm. I like to learn about local government. I like to go through, you know, high school yearbooks and see the names of people and see how, where they show up. And I'm, you know, oh, this person who's a suspect in that murder mm-hmm. actually played on the football team with the other guy, so that now I know they know each other. It's just like putting those clues together in that world is just really interesting to me. I never get tired of that. And the writing is awful. I don't really love writing, but the research and detective work is just so much fun.
How do you express that? Do you have a room where it's all over the walls? Do you keep it all digital?
I'm kind of an old school, so I like to have paper printed out and notes and stickies on margins. I have a pretty organized set of files, but I like to have it like spread out on a bed or on a desk so that I can get to stuff really quickly. I don't like the digital stuff, just flipping around. It just kind of gives me a headache.
So you don't have the wall with the strings attaching the people and the central characters like they do?
I have a wall, but I don't have that string. I should got to think about that, but I have such a small office that I don't really have a lot of room, but I do have walls with things. And, you know, there was one point, I remember after I wrote Devil in the Grove, I started one of these index card things with all these character stuff. And I think I did like 9 or 10 characters and I had it. And then 5 years later, I was cleaning out my office and I found those index cards like under a coffee cup. I was like, geez, I really meant to put those on the wall and I never got around to it. So a lot of it's sort of in my head or just like in lists of things to do.
So obviously the quality of the information you get from your sources, it can be directly proportional to your relationship with them.
Oh, yeah.
So how intentional were you about thinking about how to foster those relationships and build trust and that sort of thing?
It's really interesting because the way I got the idea for Beneath the Ruthless Sun, I was doing a talk for Devil in the Grove and this old deputy came up to me and, you know, he basically said, you got your book right. I was a deputy on McCall's force and you got it right. But why don't you write about this Jesse Daniels kid? That was same kind of, you know, Lake County story and no one ever writes about him. He goes, I think it'll be hard for you because he said that, you know, there's powerful people involved in this story and nobody will talk to you about it. And so that led me down a lot of roads where I was asking people and they were like, why are you asking about that? Like they didn't want to talk about it because they knew that families were still there. Ultimately, I think it was the patience that paid off. And in the end, I think I had everybody participating and cooperating with me, including the victim's family themselves. They turned over the diaries and the photographs and photo albums. And the family all spoke to me. And I'll never forget that act of generosity. Imagine if some like New York guy came to your house mm-hmm. and said, we want to write a book about your mother's worst moment in her life. How would you react to that? Like, I don't know how happy I'd be to see this person. And so it took a lot of writing and just explaining myself and just being there. And I ultimately presented a way that I wanted to portray that mother in an interesting way. I felt like she was morally conflicted with this conspiracy that was happening, and she kind of acted partially in a heroic way. And when I explained that to the family, they said, well, that's how we saw her, and they acknowledged it. And so that went a long way. And it was just a matter of just being patient and talking to people and basically getting them to trust that I wasn't writing something sensational. I wasn't going to exploit this story. I wanted it to be about something larger and more meaningful in America.
This jumps back a little bit, but I think in some of your other content, you mentioned being nervous. The day that the man came up to you, the deputy, and mentioned you were back in Lake County, and I think you had mentioned being nervous about going back there.
Yeah.
Can you identify what made you the most nervous? Where did you feel the greatest risk came from?
I think it was the whole way that day started. Now, this was the very first talk I did for Devil in the Grove, and I hadn't done a lot of book talks in my life at that point. I don't think it was the first, but it may have been close to the first. And for some reason, I decided to start this whole, you know, book tour basically in Groveland, in the heart of it. And it didn't really occur to me, like, I'm going into the middle of this where a lot of the family still remain. Mm-hmm. And I remember walking to the community center in Groveland thinking, you know, I really don't mind if nobody shows up to this thing. I don't know what I'm walking into. And as I got there, I saw a lot of people in the parking lot, full house, clearly cars everywhere. And now I started to get really nervous. And this woman came running out towards me before I got to the building. And she said, Mr. King, before you come in, I think it's fair to tell you that we've had two death threats called in on your appearance tonight. And I was like thinking to myself, what have I done? Like, I was terrified. So she said, you have nothing to worry about, though. We called the Lake County Sheriff's Department.
You're in good hands.
I'm like, did you read the book? And a deputy showed up who was standing behind me, which didn't really make me feel less nervous. But then when the retired deputy came up to me, he kind of stuck his business card right in my face. And all I could really see was Sheriff of Lake County on that card. And I'm like, oh no, like, who is this guy? And then as he started talking, I realized that, you know, he was actually, I did mention him in the book. Mm-hmm. He was a deputy who turned in his fellow deputies for falsifying evidence. So he was like the black sheep of the Lake County Sheriff's Department, hated McCall, hated a lot of the other deputies, but he was a great source for me because, you know, I knew that Willis McCall and his staff just destroyed all their records. They did not want that ever existing. But now I had this deputy who was inside, and he said to me, he was talking about the Jesse Daniels case. He said, you should write about it. We framed that kid. We framed him for a rape he didn't commit. And he went on to tell me exactly how they did it. So now I had this inside, like, you know, basically whistleblower,
right,
who was just so valuable. But, you know, it was terrifying going into that environment.
And has any of that, you've written three books now all around the same subject. Obviously, there's still, you know, the KKK still exists. There's white supremacists out there. Have you got any real flack from that?
Not really. I mean, you know, I'm really surprised. I just think, you know, every once in a while, something happens like that, getting a threat called in.
Yeah.
I'm not really sure that was a real threat. I think it was just kind of a harassing thing to do. You know, I just feel sometimes that, you know, stories I'm writing about, I'm a white guy 70 years later. Mm. It's a different environment. It made me think about, you know, the young African-American lawyers that were trying to get involved in seeking justice back in Jim Crow South. They had their lives on the line. And I never feel that my life is on the line. And I don't know. I just choose to not acknowledge that. You know, I try to be safe. Every once in a while, I'll go to a venue and they'll have like a deputy there for whatever reason. But I've never felt anything. I've never been confronted or anything like that. People generally talk. I think if people have read my books, they also recognize that there's sort of this sympathy and understanding. I'm not just trying to make this black versus white, good versus evil. I think the gray lines are much more interesting and what exists in the shadows of these stories. You know, some people are not great people, but they end up doing a really interesting thing and beneficial to, I think, American values. And then some people are supposed to be the beacons of society, and most of what they do is really great, but there's a couple of bad things they do. And I find that more interesting because that's much more human.
Interesting. Wonderful. I've enjoyed the conversation. I'm going to give you a fun one, a couple fun ones to end it. So you go back 30 years, you're not allowed to write about civil rights. What are you writing about?
Oh boy, that's a great question. You know, I've always been really interested in sports, you know, and I've looked really hard. I've only recently stopped looking, but I've looked so many times for a great sports story that was a little larger than sports itself. You know, maybe someone who had a great career, but they were doing something else. I have a friend, Oren Jacoby, who did a great documentary film about this champion Tour de France cyclist. But in between Tour de France's, he was like running for the resistance against Germany. And because he was such a famous biker, he was able to take documents and put them in the pipes of his bicycles. And for years and years, he was able to smuggle documents back and forth for the resistance. So I've always looked for some great story like that or something that's just larger than sports because, I don't know, I think the personalities are really large. And who knows, maybe if I found something that hasn't been explored, I would do something like that.
And, you know, your books beg to be made into movies. Any action on that front?
Well, Amazon, we had a long run with Devil in the Grove. It started out with Lionsgate, which was very exciting. And this young woman, Ali Shearmer, was really a great producer. And I think she was a lawyer and she'd studied law with one of Thurgood Marshall's clerks. So she was very much interested in Thurgood's legacy. And so she picked it up. She was the head of Lionsgate and picked it up. But then she had an untimely passing about 2 years ago and the movie kind of fell over to Amazon. And, you know, when they start changing personnel and people come and go, it's sort of fallen off that. So it's back out there and we're moving it around to other people to see who's interested. But I think there's a very strong possibility that this thing will get off the ground again. It's always a very timely story. And I think people don't really understand Thurgood Marshall's contribution. I think we all know Martin Luther King. Sometimes I go around speaking, I say, how many people here has ever heard Thurgood Marshall speak? And it's only a few hands because we don't have that newsreel footage of him. But if you do hear him and listen to him, you see how dynamic and funny he was. He was larger than life. And so I think, you know, I'm really hopeful that a character like that would really inspire cinema.
We finish each show with a shout out, someone who's doing good work that maybe flies under the radar a little bit. Anybody in mind that you want to give a little love to?
I don't know if he flies under the radar, but well, there's a few people, but one of the ones I would mention is Brian Stevenson, who's the head of the Equal Justice Initiative. I think Brian is one of those guys who, you know, he's a writer like me. He talks the talk, but he's also an attorney who has argued before the Supreme Court many times. His work with the Equal Justice Initiative and freeing innocent people from jail, he really walks the walk. And he's the greatest public speaker I've ever seen. I'm totally enraptured every time I watch him speak. And I just think he inspires the greatness of people. And I'll never be like him, but I aspire to have my work touch people the way his work touches mine. I'm just a great admirer. So Brian Stevenson would be the man I would recommend.
Wonderful. I appreciate your time.
Thanks, Joe. Pleasure.
You've made it to the end of another great episode. For more SPX, visit stpx.com. Thanks again to our sponsors, CapEx Advisory Group, Build with Confidence. CapEx provides owners representation for the most demanding construction projects. With deep knowledge of design, finance, construction, and public policy, CapEx brings your project to life. CapEx supports your organization with leadership and expertise to reduce cost and ease the burden on your team. Discover what an owner's rep can do for you. Discover CapEx Advisory Group. Visit ceag2.com. That's C-E-A-G, the number 2.com. And thanks also again to Open, the Open Partnership Education Network, which puts on great events around St. Petersburg, including Aresti speakers. To see the upcoming calendar of events, visit learnopen.org.